You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this event that we've organized together with the International Committee of the Red Cross on engaging with armed groups, legal and operational challenges for humanitarian action. My name is Beth Ferris. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings and co-director of the Brookings LSE Project on Internal Displacement, which works on a whole range of humanitarian issues. You know, the landscape in which humanitarian actors are working these days has become extraordinarily complex. Not only are there thousands and thousands of NGOs, myriad UN agencies, governmental actors galore, but also increasingly non-state actors that take many different forms, ranging from criminal gangs to so-called terrorist groups to armed groups that have different political objectives, different ways of working, impose different kinds of challenges to humanitarians trying to get access to communities affected by violence or disaster. So we organize this together with ICRC to explore some of the challenges of working with armed groups. We've got three different panelists here, each of which will be speaking from their own particular area of expertise. We have Vonda Felbaugh-Brown, who's a fellow here at Foreign Policy, does research on illicit economies, armed groups, has certainly had the most unusual travel schedule, I'm sure, of anybody else at Brookings in terms of going out to meet with, observe, study, analyze, and occasionally even run away from armed groups. And she's going to provide an overall context of the ways in which particularly states are dealing with armed actors. She'll then be followed by Vincent Bernard, who's sitting at my far left here, who's the editor-in-chief of the International Review of the Red Cross, which is actually being launched here today, this special edition on armed groups. And we're very glad to give some publicity to this important publication. Vincent has worked with ICRC for 15 years, both in the field and places such as Gaza-occupied Palestinian territories, Senegal, and other places, and quite a few different positions at headquarters as well. Then we'll have Marcos Assoli, who's the director of the Department of International Law and International Organization at the University of Geneva, and he also chairs the board of Geneva Call. He's going to give us some of the legal dimensions of negotiating or working with armed groups in the context of their increasing activity. So we'll start with Vonda, and then perhaps we'll go to the law, and then we'll have the practice of what it's like on the ground to be working with armed actors. Vonda, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. It's a great pleasure to be here on an aspect of international politics that is, in my view, going to be an increasing feature of the next several decades, both for states and non-state actors, to humanitarian actors, NGOs, to be engaging with armed actors. And then it's an aspect of international relations that is perhaps not as explored and studied as should be the case. So it's great to be here. Thank you, Beth, for organizing the panel. Thank you for putting out the issue. Now, why did I say that I think that increasingly armed actors and other non-state actors, including armed actors, will be an important feature of the times that are ahead that have already started? Well, one reason is the obvious. Already today, there are very many non-governed or spaces or places that are not governed, I should say, by states, be it the borderlands of Pakistan as well as the center parts of Karachi or Jakarta, or be it parts of Somalia or Colombia or Mexico today. And of course, in the past decade, very much of a part of nation building, of foreign policy in which the United States has engaged, was interacting with armed actors, both criminal actors as well as militant actors. But one of the trends that is increasing urbanization. And already today, in many cities, the state really does not have the capacity to extend its presence, especially its multifaceted presence, to large parts of urban areas. And as the pace of urbanization increases, these urban slums governed by drug lords, warlords, slumlords, mungiki, vigilante groups will be increasingly frequent in the context of a century where cities will play perhaps greater political role than they have in a long time. Now, from the perspective of the state, it's quite possible to ignore these slum areas or other urban areas as well as rural peripheries that are governed by other actors where the state is not present. But often the state does it at its own risk, at its own danger, that at some point the governance, alternative governance emerging in these places and the problems festering in these places will spill and the state will encounter them. And then perhaps the challenge that the state will encounter will be far greater than merely dealing with an armed actor, but de facto dealing with a proto-state. The armed actors are, of course, extremely varied, and groups vary very much by their ideology or its absence. Criminal groups are not identical with ideologically motivated groups. Groups vary by their organizational structure, their hierarchy or network-like characters. The anonymous is, of course, a very different actor, not armed actor, than, for example, the Somali pirates. But more and more, especially in the context of armed actors, the state will encounter armed exchanges with them in a way that really borders or approximates warfare. And arguably, what we are seeing today in Mexico really borders on its intensity on war. And in this case, it's quite not inappropriate to call the brutality and the violence in Mexico a war on drugs and war within drug trafficking groups. Similarly, in places such as Rio de Janeiro or Colombia's Medellin, when the state decided to retake areas governed by armed actors, in this case criminal groups, it really mounted operations that approximated very much or in fact were akin to urban warfare that we would see in the settings of outright civil war in urban places, for example. And it might seem quite straightforward what kind of threats these actors place to states. However, the interactions between such armed actors and society are often highly complex. And they are all the more complicated if the state is so deficient in its presence that these actors really come to function as the proto-state entities. Especially if they can mobilize illegal economies, they really become the provider of socioeconomic benefits. If they are really clever, they become the provider of public goods, and not simply public goods such as access to jobs, for example, but public goods such as the provision of order and rule of law, the provision of crime suppression policies. Now, you might be surprised to hear me say that a criminal group like the PCC in Sao Paulo, for example, is the provider of crime suppression. Of course, it's a criminal group. It generates violence. It's the source of homicides. It's the source of kidnapping and extortion. But at the same time, it regulates the intensity and shape of violence, extortion, homicides. It appropriates the monopoly of power or close to monopoly of power in areas where it operates. All the more so that the state is, if the state is weak or absent. And so if the state is really deficient in providing public goods, both rule of law, contract enforcement goods, as well as socioeconomic goods, the populations in such areas might very well transfer their allegiance to the groups away from the state. And their primary social identification might very well be with the criminal gangs or political gang or political actors like the Taliban, or in the case of Somalia, the pirate gangs. And often such gangs or such armed actors not only compete for the allegiance with the state, they might very well compete for the allegiance with traditional traditional political elites, be it the tribal Maliks in Pakistan or be it the clan elites in Somalia. But nonetheless, they have the capacity to accumulate what I call political capital and really become the principal source of order in the area. And so if the state then decides to challenge them, it often needs to do so through far more complex, far more multifaceted mechanism than simply law enforcement or military might. really needs to expand its multifaceted presence, because much of the competition stops being merely about the physical control of territory or the exchange of physical power, but it's really about capturing the allegiance of the population. And this is true even if one thinks or talks purely about criminal groups. Not all criminal groups are alike, but it's too simplistic to say, on the one hand, that political groups like the FARC in Colombia have lost political ideology, or that what distinguishes criminal actors is that they do not have political effects. In fact, that is not the case. They often have deep political effects, deep effects on how society is aligned with them or the state. Now, if the state decides that it wants to confront these groups in a very limited way, let them go on, or just occasionally confront them through military action without really fully incorporating these areas into the areas of state presence and extending multifaceted state presence, the worst thing it can do is then to criminalize the engagement of humanitarian actors and other actors with those marginalized populations. And to say that, for example, money cannot flow into Somalia during the context of an extreme crisis, there cannot be a guarantee that the money will not seep to al-Shabaab. In the context of non-state presence, obviously the non-state actors, in the context of state absence, obviously the non-state actors will control the territory and will demand a cut of the money. And so for the state to say you cannot engage because some of the money might go to these entities that we cannot control or we chose to ignore, that means that the marginalized populations will become completely aligned and completely dependent on these actors, not because they prefer them, but because that's the only game available in town. It's the only provider of public goods or socioeconomic goods. Let me conclude by speaking about the Taliban in Afghanistan, where... you know, the question is often asked in polling whether people like the Taliban, and the answer inevitably comes, no, we do not like the Taliban, Afghans. But it's also a completely irrelevant question. The only question that matters to the population is not whether they like the Taliban, but whether there is anyone else available to them as a governing entity that they might like better. And if the answer is no, there isn't. The Taliban is the only provider of rule, the only provider of both security and insecurity, then that's the ruling entity that the population is left with. And so in this case, to say, well, we will not provide aid or humanitarian actors cannot get into the territory because the Taliban or the Somali pirates or al-Shabaab might get their access to some of the resources, means that these populations are forever bound to simply these non-state actors and cannot ever transfer their allegiance to the state or the international order.
Well, that's a rather grim introduction to a complex issue. Tell us, Marco, what the international humanitarian law and legal norms have to say. And you might want to talk a little bit about your experience in working with some non-state actors on issues of IHL, international humanitarian law.
So thank you for having invited me. Indeed, now perhaps I take the hat of the international lawyer and I speak about the international law. Perhaps after Vincent, if you allow, I take the other hat, which is I'm chairing the board of Geneva Call, which is an NGO trying to engage armed groups to respect some humanitarian norms. So I would start with international law, which, despite all modern theories, has something to do with states, and it is still obsessed by states. And while international reality, and I fully agree with you, is more and more also dominated by non-state actors, think about multinational enterprises, NGOs, armed groups, terrorist groups, and so on. International law is still very, despite all tendencies, state-focused. It is basically made by states, and we come back to that. That's a problem. It is, with some exceptions, addressed to states. It is enforced by states. And you have many more mechanisms to enforce international law against states. I mean, if your human rights have been violated by a state, you have a whole list of more or less efficient mechanisms to get your human rights be respected. But even those who, like my friend Andrew Clapham, who is in the room, say that human rights are also addressed to non-state actors, have to admit that there are less mechanisms. Now, in international humanitarian law, at least since 1949, it clearly addresses non-state armed groups. That's in the famous Article 3 common to the four Geneva Conventions, which applies to non-international armed conflicts. And I start from the idea that every armed conflict which is not international is necessarily non-international. And I have the U.S. Supreme Court with me in the Hamdan case. It says, in the case of armed conflict not of an international character, blah, 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 each party, capital P, to the conflict shall be bound to apply as a minimum the following provisions, and then you have a sort of mini Geneva Convention. And this means two things. First of all, and states don't like to hear that, necessarily armed groups are subjects of international law as far as humanitarian law is concerned, because you cannot ask someone to respect the rules if that person or entity is not a subject of the law. For instance, the Canadian Criminal Code prohibition of murder is not addressed to polar bears. And when a polar bear kills a tourist, that polar bear did not violate the Canadian Criminal Code because it's not the subject of the Canadian Criminal Code. And the same thing is true for armed groups. It would be meaningless, the rules on non-international armed conflicts, which are also addressed to armed groups, if they were not subjects. This rule means also each party, that both parties are bound by the same rules. And this is a very basic principle, which in this issue of the review I challenge for the purpose of debate with Yuval Chani, but Yuval Chani is not here, so I have to defend both positions. So the basic principle in humanitarian law is equality of the belligerents before humanitarian law. Both parties have to have the same rights and the same obligations as far as humanitarian law is concerned. And this is very important, I must agree. For non-international armed conflict, sometimes it is controversial of who is the government and who are the rebels. Think about Libya, think about Ivory Coast. And second, from a humanitarian point of view, it is obviously important that the victims are protected on both sides the same way, and it's not your fault if you are a civilian that you are happening to live on the wrong side. And if you had differentiated rules for armed groups and states, you would be less protected if you happen to be the victim of an armed group. And even morally, one can not automatically say, I hope I will not be arrested, that states are always right and armed groups always wrong. Okay, so this is the equality of the belligerents. What applies equally to both sides? It's the law of non-international armed conflicts, which is made up of Article 3 to the Geneva Conventions, Protocol Additional 2 at a slightly higher level because the armed group has to control territory for the protocol to apply. And today, one would mainly add customary law. And here we have a little problem because a very welcome development of the last 20 years is that the law of non-international armed conflict has become closer to the law of international armed conflict. through the jurisprudence of international criminal tribunals, the Tadic case, and the Yugoslavia tribunal somehow had to manipulate slightly the law because they didn't really know whether it's international or non-international, and so they simply said, well, it doesn't matter because anyway the rules are the same, and they claimed the rules are the same because in the treaties they are clearly not the same, that this is due to customary law. And the International Committee of the Red Cross has made a study about customary international humanitarian law and has come to the conclusion that out of 161 rules of humanitarian customary humanitarian law, 136, I think, arguably 141, are the same in international and non-international armed conflict, which is good for the victims of governments. And how could a government, this is the famous sentence of the regretted Judge Cassese, how could the government justify to do something to their own people, which it is prohibited to do in an international armed conflict against an enemy? Now, the problem is non-international armed the law of non-international armed conflict is also addressed to armed groups. And there, in my view, we have always, before we interpret a rule of humanitarian law, before we claim a rule is customary law, before we develop humanitarian law of non-international armed conflict, to think about whether it is realistic for an armed group, because an armed group is different from a state. And unrealistic rules do not protect anyone and undermine the willingness of the addressees to respect even the realistic rules. For instance, the prohibition of torture. If an armed group has the impression that I try to sell the group plenty of rules which they cannot comply with, they say this branch is not for me. And therefore, they do not even feel themselves bound by the rules which are realistic. Another factor which has brought the two branches closer and which creates problems for armed groups, with all respect to my friend Andrew Clapham, is is international human rights law, because obviously under human rights law, non-international armed conflicts, international armed conflicts, and non-conflict situations are governed by the same rules, which is justified for government, while more and more rules of humanitarian law are interpreted in the light of human rights law, and there it becomes more delicate for an armed group, because first of all, it's very controversial whether armed groups are bound by human rights law, but it's even more difficult than for humanitarian law for an armed group to respect those rules. I give you some examples where practically there is a problem. For instance, there is an uncontroversial customary rule prohibiting arbitrary detention. Who in this room is in favor of arbitrary detention? Now, if this is a rule of humanitarian law of non-international armed conflict, then it also applies to armed groups. What does arbitrary detention mean? According to the ICSE study, not to be arbitrary, detention must have a legal basis, and there must be a possibility to check the lawfulness, to challenge the lawfulness of the detention. Now, how does an armed group make a legal basis? And especially, how do you define the jurisdiction of an armed group? I mean, they create a legal basis, but the legal basis is applicable to whom? And then habeas corpus procedure by armed groups is not such an easy thing. And therefore, you could say, okay, but armed groups shouldn't detain anyone. But this, sorry, is unrealistic. If you fight an armed conflict and you want to have those who fight respect those who surrender or are otherwise order combat, you must allow them to detain people. And to call any detention by an armed group taking of hostage is not helping people, but is encouraging summary executions. Two other examples are pillage. You know, I'm against pillage. But what's the definition of pillage? One of the elements of pillage is appropriation without the consent of the owner. Now, international law does not really say who is the owner of natural resources. So we look into domestic law, and under domestic law of most countries, it's the government. And so the government never commits pillage if it exploits natural resources, and the armed group. Take the SPLA in southern Sudan. Now it's a state, so that's different. But before, it was an armed group. And as soon as it exploited natural resources of their people on their territory, this was legally pillage. Don't try to sell them this rule of humanitarian law. And the last one, last example in my article, I give some other ones, is the rule on child soldiers. Please don't believe that I'm in favor of child soldiers. And I'm even sensitive to the 18-year straight argument. And I'm sensitive to the gender argument that girls are much often more exploited not to fight directly, but otherwise associated with armed groups. The result of this is that everyone of goodwill in the world considers that children should not at all be associated with armed groups, but children obviously may be associated with states, with governments. And please don't try to convince a Karen rebel in Myanmar that he should fight and let his family and his children in the hand of the government, which he considers will simply try to eliminate the Karen people. Okay, what can we do about this? There are basically two possibilities, and this is the discussion I have with Yuval Shani, and I fully understand his argument. Don't think that I'm so convinced of my argument. One possibility is we keep the equality of the belligerents, but then we should not develop too much the rules of humanitarian law, but we should not forget that humanitarian law is not alone. There is human rights law, and so the government is bound by basic rules of humanitarian law, Article 3 Common, for instance, and, if applicable, Protocol 2, and, in addition, by plenty of rules of international human rights law, which, even if humanitarian law is the lex specialis, as the lex specialis doesn't say anything, we look into the lex generalis, which is human rights law, while the armed groups, again, with all respect to my friend Andrew, the armed group would simply be bound by humanitarian law. So they remain equal, but simply another branch adds up to. Or, and this is my proposal, here we abandon the equality of belligerents before humanitarian law, because it is a fiction, and the fiction doesn't protect anyone. And then we would have the government bound by the full rules of international humanitarian law in a non-international armed conflict, while an armed group fighting against the government would only be bound according to a sliding scale of obligations. The more territorial control, organization, the higher the degree of violence, the more rules of international humanitarian law of, like, international armed conflicts they would be bound to. And now you will ask me, okay, but is this a proposal de lege ferenda? Should we make new Geneva Conventions? I'm not sure, because it is somehow the existing law. Article 3 Common is a minimum which can and must be respected by everyone. Protocol 2, often criticized by humanitarian because it has a higher threshold. It requires territorial control, and I think this is realistic, because many rules, you can respect them only if you control territory. How can you try a person without controlling territory? And then the rest is customary law. And here I come to my last point. The existing customary law, which has been found based on state practice, according to the ICSC customary law study, customary law by definition, is always realistic. Customary law cannot be unrealistic because it's based on practice. The problem is only here, it is based on practice, and even there one can have some doubts, but ICSE simply bases it on what states say, not what states actually do, which is defendable in public international law. It's based on state practice. While if we look also at the practice of non-state armed groups, then my sliding scale corresponds to existing customary law, because in reality, armed groups don't respect rules which they are unable to respect. And therefore, if customary law, in my view, has a sense, it must be based on the practice of those who are the addressees of the rules. And therefore, I submit that it is possible to claim that my proposal is not a proposal, but is the existing law.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's certainly a lot to think about. Vincent, tell us about operational challenges of working with non-state actors.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you for co-organizing this event. We appreciate a lot the commitment of Brookings in fostering this debate on humanitarian policy. I'd like also to thank Cambridge University Press. We have Finola O'Sullivan, the editorial director of legal publications at Cambridge, our publisher for this edition. I guess you have received copies of this edition at the entrance. It's actually the first edition on armed groups. The second one will be on engaging armed groups. So we started with understanding armed groups, and I think with your presentation, Vanda, we got already a very good introduction on the problem. With Marco discussing about the law and its limits, somehow the limits of the law when it comes to promote compliance by armed groups. And my part will be on engaging armed groups, and I would like to talk about the experience of the ICRC. And I would like to start with a small story, which happened to one of my colleagues some years ago in West Africa. He was going to meet an armed group in the field, not in a nice setting like this beautiful room you have here, probably in the open, and he met a militia in West Africa. These guys were under drugs. They were really tough warriors. They were guilty of looting, abuse against civilians. And his role was to explain the work of the ICRC and to give them an introduction on international humanitarian law. And so he started talking, breaking the ice. So what's your name? One of them said, my name is Rambo. Okay, and you? Easy trigger. Okay. And then, you know, he gave his presentation, and at the end, he opened for questions. You know, and Easy Trigger raised his hand and said, "Mr. Delegate of the Red Cross, I have a question." "Please go ahead, Easy Trigger. My question is, what is the penalty in international humanitarian law for killing a Red Cross delegate?" And I think it's both a funny story. And it's a sad story at the same time. But it shows a lot. It shows first that there are crazy people going there and meeting these warriors and trying to secure access for humanitarian operations. It shows that we need to engage with armed groups for security. It's about security. It's about, you know, protecting the lives of the people, the humanitarian workers going in the field. But it's also talking about the law and their understanding of the law and the fact that we can actually discuss these things. We can actually start discussing about the impact of having an international criminal court and the possibility to have you know, sanctions. So I'd like to start with this. I think it sets the scenes for the question of how to engage armed groups. So Marco said, okay, we would like to move away from equality in international humanitarian law. There are, in many ways, differences between states and armed groups. Both can violate the law. It's not only armed groups violating the law today. So that has to be said. But they are unequal also in their capacity to respect the law. They don't have the same mechanisms. And I think Marco gave lots of illustrations of that. So this is why we need to go and meet them also, because they have less capacities to implement their obligations. So there is a need to engage Ambrose. And that's why we have decided to devote two editions of the review. For those who are not familiar with our journal, the review, the International Review of the Red Cross, is a very old publication on humanitarian action. It started in 1869, actually. So I think it qualifies as the oldest publication in this field. And today, when we prepare an edition, we try to have three types of articles or elements to build an edition. We'd like to focus on the problem first. Second, we'd like to look at the law and the challenges to make it respected in the field, in reality. And finally, we look at humanitarian response and its challenges. So with armed groups, I think we have quite a lot. And this panel here reflects also the way we have built our outline. So I really encourage you to have a look, and also to maybe in the future help us in our project to disseminate this law and discuss areas to develop the law. So let me give you very briefly, let's say, three main elements on ICRC and armed groups. First, I would like to talk about the findings of the ICRC working in the field all around the world in so many non-international conflict situations and our reading of the humanitarian situation. Then I will talk about how we engage armed groups. And finally, I will talk about engaging armed groups on international humanitarian law. So first, I would like to talk about our findings and our reading of the situation all around the world. I'm not talking here from a think tank perspective or as a researcher, but based on the operations of the ICRC. And maybe a few facts on what we see in the field. Today, we see that the nature of armed conflicts continue to evolve. And the predominant form, as is well known, is non-international armed conflicts. In 2011, the ICRC has qualified 48 contexts as situations of non-international armed conflicts. Among these contexts, you have old conflicts like Afghanistan, which has been going on for 30 years, and you had new conflicts like Côte d'Ivoire or Libya. 48 situations, but very different. We see conflicts which are completely forgotten, with sometimes very low level of violence. Sometimes we see conflicts involving international forces with a very big asymmetry between the two parties. So they are very different from each other. Another important element is that we have a great diversity of armed groups. We are talking about armed groups today, and we have already evoked the fact that some of them are very different. Some of them can control territories. Some are very small. We have identified 170 armed groups in these situations where we work. Depending on the way you assess criteria for armed groups, you can possibly find many more armed groups. And this does not include gangs or maras or other groups we find in other situations. The nature of violence has changed a lot, and it primarily targets civilians. Confrontations between armed groups and governments or among armed groups are actually quite rare. Most of the violence is against the civilian population, which in non-international armed conflict is the prize, is the main goal to control the civilian population. And they are the ones suffering from the brutality of non-international conflicts, sometimes by armed groups, sometimes also victims of counter-guerrilla tactics. We also observe that these conflicts are less and less ideologically driven, and that it's very difficult sometimes to distinguish between criminality and political motives. So even armed groups which used to have a political agenda tend to use criminal activities to, for instance, get funds and support their military operations, or even not support their military operations, but simply support their existence. And of course, we see that outside conflict situations, so below the threshold of applicability of international maritime law, violence is also on the rise, with situations where actually violence is even higher than in some conflicts that we see in the world. After these few elements on the situation, I'd like to talk now about the engagement, how ICRC engage armed groups and why. And there again, I would like to start with a few examples which are happening today. In the coming days, the ICRC will facilitate the release of the last military and police officers still detained by the FARC in Colombia. I think it's something we are preparing for the coming days. It was supposed to take place today, but I think the operation has been delayed until Monday, so we hope this will happen. It's a very important move by the FARC also to release these people. A few weeks ago, the ICRC visited 72 Yemeni soldiers, government soldiers, who are detained by a group which is very close to Al-Qaeda, which is called Ansar al-Sharia in Yemen. So we are talking here about detention of government soldiers by armed groups. And this also to echo what Marco said. Armed groups actually detain government forces. And here we can play an important role to visit these soldiers detained by armed groups. At the moment, we are in contact with opposition and all parties, actually, in Syria. So this is also very important in order to get access to some areas in Syria. So these contacts are taking place on a daily basis. And these contacts between the ICRC and armed groups are actually not new. It's also so striking to sometimes to mention this, and people are astonished. You say, wow, you're meeting these guys, you're meeting the Taliban. And some people are really shocked to hear that. But actually, we've been doing that for quite a number of years. It started during the First World War, actually after the First World War, during the Russian Revolution. And since then, ICRC has been operating in non-international armed conflicts in dialogue with both parties. So we do that first because as a humanitarian organization, we want to work in close proximity to victims. And in order to assess their needs, we need to operate in the conflict area, so we need to engage with both parties. And international maritime law provides us with a basis to do that. Article 3, common Article 3 that you mentioned, gives the possibility for the ICRC to offer its services to the parties of a non-international conflict. And we do that, let's admit it, first for our own security. Because we need safe access, we need acceptance to have access to detainees, to meet, for instance, these Yemeni soldiers, to have access to the population in the war zone. We need this access to provide assistance, to provide protection for the detainees, and we also need this access to engage armed groups on the law, on respect for the law. How to do it, and there I could speak for a long time, but I know I have to refrain from that. Very often it's a catch-22. Dialogue is facilitated by operations. Dialogue is not based simply on principles or on Article 3. Very often it is linked to demonstrating our impartiality, our neutrality in the field. So operations and dialogue come together, but very often it's a catch-22 situation. For instance, in Afghanistan in 2003, when one of our colleagues was killed, we lost access to the field. How do you reestablish this access when you don't have actually operations, when you're not really directly useful, when people don't know exactly what you can bring to the population? So access, dialogue, and operations go together. So you need to find ways to engage armed groups, to assess the needs, and to find the niche which will allow you to operate in a context like Afghanistan. In the case I mentioned, in 2006, it was possible to resume activities because we identified the need to bring first aid in the provinces because many people could not travel within Afghanistan, could not reach the hospitals, and so we started to build a network in the field, which, of course, allowed us to have more and more contacts with the armed opposition and then facilitated our possibility to have access to these areas. Of course, there are many challenges which come from armed groups themselves, but also sometimes from the perspective of governments, which see the engagement with armed groups as a kind of recognition or giving them some kind of legitimacy. And governments can also restrict our capacity to engage armed groups. Maybe we'll come back to that later. My last point is on engaging armed groups to respect the law. And here, I'm also very often facing the comment that people perceive armed groups as criminals. And they tend to think that armed groups are unable to respect the law by definition. Why? Because in an asymmetric conflict, they will hide among the population. So they tend to, you know, live off the population and use tactics to spread terror, and they are perceived as violating armed groups. Sometimes, indeed, they deliberately violate international humanitarian law. There is this electoral slogan that Charles Taylor used in 1997 when he was re-elected as president of Liberia. His slogan, is it the right term, was, "He killed my ma, he killed my pa, but I will vote for him." Because, yes, spreading terror was a tactic to control population, and people would possibly, yes, prefer to have these armed groups, which is spreading terror among the population, controlling the situation so at least they find a stability. Because for the population, the big question is, should I rely on armed groups? Should I rely on the government? Where will I find stability? What are the rules of the game? Who can provide me with security? And sometimes they will choose armed groups, as you suggested also, Wanda. But some groups have actually good reasons to comply. And in the review, you'll find several articles. In this edition, there is one article on the arguments which can also convince armed groups to comply with the law. It would be a bit too long to go to describe them. But definitely some groups can actually respect the law. And I've met personally, you know, a former rebel and a former soldier at the same table after the internal conflict was over. And one of them had been detained by the other guy. But they were very good friends because they actually managed to do that in a proper way. And once the war was over, they were all both integrated in the National Army. It is possible that armed groups respect the law, very often for public relations, for their self-esteem, for their image. There are many arguments that can be used to convince them to respect the law. And actually, ICRC is engaged in these communication programs and very often base its work on local traditions, local culture, and try to identify, looking at armed groups, not let's say, through their political agenda, but looking at the reality of armed groups, trying to understand them so as to find the mechanisms which will make them respect the law. And there we need to have a very pragmatic approach. But dissemination or convincing them to respect the law is probably not enough. And we need to work on some mechanisms which will create a commitment on their side and for which they will be accountable. So ICRC has also made a study, and we identify several mechanisms like agreements, declarations, unilateral declarations, inclusion of international humanitarian law in codes of conduct. And here also we publish a collection of codes of conduct by armed groups. It's quite fascinating to see how, you know, they perceive their obligations and how they define their obligations. In a previous edition, we published the code of conduct of the Taliban in Afghanistan, which really describes the way they look at their obligations, the treatment of prisoners, how to win hearts and minds of the population, because the Taliban are also concerned about winning hearts and minds. And sometimes these codes of conduct are not according to the law, but it shows that on their side also there are possibilities to create commitment. So to conclude, armed groups today are a major reality, and they are bound by the law. So we have a responsibility in engaging with armed groups to discuss these issues. We need to understand them and we need to look beyond stated political motives. Not armed groups are the same, and we tend to think that armed groups always violate the law. It's actually not true. They can make decisions to respect or not the law, and so we need to be capable of helping them in this. Conversely, perceptions by armed groups matters, because if we need to understand them, they will also look at us, and they will look at our operations, and they will look at our principles, and we better walk the talk. We see today that very few humanitarian organizations are capable of operating in conflict areas. And there, we think that humanitarian organizations have also, when they want to engage with armed groups, to question the way they operate. And we think that neutrality and independence and impartiality are key principles in our experience in building this capacity to engage armed groups. Humanitarian organizations also tend to limit themselves at security issues and possibly securing access. But I think, and I think also in the ICRC, we need more and more to go beyond access and security, and we need to really tackle this issue of engaging armed groups on respect of the law more seriously and be very ambitious in our work on that. However, and I want to conclude on that, this is a very challenging endeavor. And armed groups are not well equipped and sometimes are not willing to respect the law. So we have to be ambitious, but we have to be realistic. Many of these armed groups won't be in a position to respect the law or not willing to do that, but we still have to continue. I think it's, time for questions now.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Vincent, and all of our panelists. We have time for questions, comments, et cetera, and we have microphones that will magically appear. We'll have right here at the front. And if it's okay, we'll take two or three and then give you a chance to respond. And if you could identify yourself, please.
Samar Chatterjee from SAFE Foundation. You've talked about armed groups. Now, and also plunder, I guess, those were the terms used. And I'm wondering, when United States invades Afghanistan or Iraq, is it considered an armed group? Because it's behaving in an illegal manner, and so it should be treated as an armed group. And therefore, and since you said you're teaching the armed group to follow the law, are you able to teach these governments who behave like armed group the law? Because United States is in violation of a lot of things during these Afghan and Iraqi wars and so on. So that's the question.
Okay. Other questions? You have over here one? Yes.
Thank you very much. Andrew Clapham from the Geneva Academy of International Humanitarian Law and Human Rights. I think on the question of engaging an armed group and suggesting to them that they have exactly the same obligations as the state that they're fighting against, Professor Marcus Sassley is absolutely right that it's not a realistic way to start. And therefore, I think his suggestion that there should be what he calls a sliding scale is actually a very good one. And I don't think it goes against the foundation of international humanitarian law to suggest that a rebel group is not in the same position as a state, and therefore we can expect less. What I'd like to add into the mix, as he prefigured, is that I think we can do the same thing with human rights law. Human rights law does already operate on a sliding scale for states. We don't expect the same of Togo and France when it comes to the right to health or the right to education. There's a sliding scale. I mean, human rights, of course, with torture, it's exactly the same. But most human rights, there's a built-in sliding scale. And what I wanted to suggest to the panel is that maybe it's useful to think about a sliding scale of human rights obligations for the groups, the armed groups. Now, where I part company with Marcus Sassley slightly is I'm not sure that that sliding scale should be generated by the practice of the group. I think the sliding scale can be generated by human rights law. And why am I insisting so much on human rights law? It's because in many of the situations that you've been talking about, and one could mention Rio or even Syria, when the Commission of Inquiry went to Syria, there was no armed conflict. So the Commission of Inquiry had to work out what standard to hold that armed group to. And if you read the report to the Human Rights Council, they say we're using human rights against the armed group, but not the same human rights obligations that we're going to impose on Syria. It's a much reduced set of rights, which seems to me to be eminently practical. And I'd like the comments of the panel on that. Thank you.
Okay, another question I have. Let's take the woman right here, one and then two.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Kathy Rizzo of the Public International Law and Policy Group. My question may be a broad question, but can any of the panelists speak to any engagement that's being done with Libyan militias right now or ideal situations that you could see happening in this situation?
And so we'll take one more question here, and then we'll give the panelists a chance to respond.
My name is Zakaria Dabone. Oh. It is just a small question from a student to his professor. And when I defend my thesis more than 1 year ago, the professor Sassori asked me, when I talk about armed conflict party, I talk about a government or I talk about the state. It is an opportunity for me today to ask back. And for you, dear professor, when you read Article 3 of the Geneva Convention, do you talk about a government or do you talk about the state, and what are the implications or effects of your answer on the question of equality? In the practice field, if I take the example, the Mali example, actually, I think the rebel group, the Tuareg rebel group today is stronger than the government. It is a context of civil war and coup d'etat. So I think the rebel group is stronger. And in this case, what is the issue and implication on the question of equality? Thank you.
Okay, we have some varied questions here. Who defines an armed group? Can a state be an armed group in terms of respect for international law? The sliding scale of applicability of human rights law, could that be a useful way to proceed? Anything you know about Libyan militias? And the government versus state question, with particularly with respect to the situation presently in Mali. Who would like to jump in? Bonda, you want to start?
I'll make just one comment on the sliding scale from the perspective of the population not being an international lawyer and not being a representative of the humanitarian community. But in many ways, the sliding scale does operate because populations have very different expectations of what is right, what is wrong, what are the responsibilities that they place on non-state actors than they place on governments. Often this is very frustrating from the perspectives of government or counterinsurgency forces, police forces, because they'll point out, look, the Taliban is the cause of 75% of civilian casualties, for example. We make every possible considerations to minimize civilian casualties. We do cause them, but we are always blamed so much more for the one violation or one slippage than the non-state actor. And this is the same, be it the police in Rio or be it the ISAF forces in Afghanistan. And the reality is that populations, even in these extremely marginalized and victimized circumstances, have a sense that the state, by the virtue of being the state or the international forces, have far greater obligations to respect rights and to deliver services than armed actors do. And so armed actors have this great playing advantage of being able to minimize and justify and excuse their violations far more than state do. And if armed actors deliver some sort of service, it is met with far greater appreciation, far greater gratitude by the populations than when state do that. But that's the reality. And I think that as long as the exchange between military forces or law enforcement forces and the population is, look, you don't apply the same standards, it's a losing game. The reality is that the standard is different, and the question is not to focus on this different perception, but to maximize the good behavior and minimize the bad behavior on the part of the state.
Thank you. Marco.
Well, first, the U.S. is not an armed group. It's a state. Humanitarian law is addressed to states, so you don't have to call it an armed group to it to be bound by international humanitarian law. And it's precisely very important with armed groups. The underlying assumption that people acting illegally are armed groups is not true. I mean, it doesn't matter whether someone acts legally or illegally. They are bound, if they are engaged in armed conflicts, by international humanitarian law. And as far as I know, not the ICC is certainly, I would say, very much engaged in trying to get states respect the law and disseminating law to the states. And I, what is perhaps not so much existing is precisely for the armed groups, so we have to push more there. But I agree with you, and it's very important to clarify that both states and armed groups violate humanitarian law, and the fact that states violate humanitarian law has never been used as an argument for saying don't engage them because they violate. And it is precisely when the ICSE, for instance, in the Second World War, did not engage a profoundly inhuman regime on respect of humanitarian law that then it was criticized, rightly so. And today, states, many states, expect from humanitarian organizations not to engage certain armed groups because they are so inhumane. No, that's the starting point. And a theoretical armed group or a theoretical state which perfectly complies with IHL, you don't even have to engage it. On the sliding scale of human rights obligations, I have a theoretical and a practical remark. The theoretical remark is obviously the human rights treaties are not binding upon armed groups, and unlike the humanitarian law treaties. So we have to go through customary law. And in my view, the same issue comes up. But in my view, the same, and here I am with you, similar responses can be given. And as the greatest positivist in international law, Dionisio Anzalotti, said, logic is the source of international law, not only the will of state. And therefore, I would say it would be very useful if someone was making an analysis in detail, which rules of human rights law are binding for which armed groups in what situations? What does the allegedly inderogable right to habeas corpus practically mean for an armed group, for instance? And then an answer to my former doctoral student who wrote a whole entire thesis on armed groups, and he has also written an article in this review, on armed groups in international law. First, there, a practical remark. It is one of the possibilities which works well with armed groups which want to become in charge of a state or create a new state, secessionist group, or a group which wants to become the government. It's one of the better arguments which convinces them to say, you want to be the government of XY, well, start to comply with the obligations of XY, because the obligations of international law are not obligations of governments, but of states. And it is interesting that armed groups which do not want to become a state, the Taliban want to become a state, Al-Qaeda doesn't want to become a state, it's easier to engage groups which want to become a state than those which do not want. And my theoretical answer is, indeed, the parties to non-international armed conflicts are, in my view, the government and the rebels, and not the state and the rebels. But obviously, it's the government, as you better know than I, which represents in international law the state, and except in situations like Côte d'Ivoire, where you don't exactly know, This means that in particular in transnational, non-international armed conflict, that's another crazy thing of lawyers, but say Afghanistan is a transnational, non-international armed conflict because it's different states, including the U.S., fighting against a non-state actor, which will soon again be the state. But that's another story. Okay, and there you have to say that those third states intervening on the side of what is still the government of Afghanistan obviously have their obligations as not the government, but as states. Perhaps later I can make some remarks about Geneva Corps.
Mm-hmm. Then why don't we take another round and then we'll come back. Mm-hmm. So I've had this gentleman here from before. So I have one and then Jenny.
Beth, maybe I should say a word on Libya.
Yeah.
Okay. And maybe just very shortly because most has been said. Well, to go back to states, of course there are also dissemination efforts with states and we have programs all over the world to engage states also on respect for the law. Sometimes our groups are very well organized, and I remember the SPLA had an Institute for Strategic Studies which was capable of training officers. So actually, I agree with Marco, it's easier when a group wants to become a state. Another thing I want to say about the law, and here, maybe to refer to what you said, the humanitarian needs come first. We need to be pragmatic. And many of these dialogue on the law, on the respect for the law, maybe will take place without us mentioning the law. You enter the compound of an armed group and you see that there are child soldiers, and then you engage with the rebel leader and discuss about, you know, why are they here? What are we doing for these child soldiers? Do you really need them? And start the discussion. It's possibly not a legal discussion. So we need to be pragmatic. We need to look at the humanitarian needs first, and then the law will help us and give us some tools. But that's a lesson we learn from history also, that you look at the humanitarian needs, and then the law will provide you with the tools to address some problems, but very often these negotiations or these discussions are not legal ones. They can be very pragmatic. Regarding Libya, very briefly, when the crisis started in Libya, I think very quickly MSF came in from Egypt, entered into Benghazi. ICRC came also. We didn't have contacts with the Libyan government before. We were not present in Libya. Very quickly, we also established an office in Tripoli, and ICRC could work with both sides. And so there are plenty of examples of engaging with the armed groups during the Libya crisis, and those armed groups now have become the government of Libya. But there are, many things on which we work together, including detention of the, let's say, pro-Qaddafi captured by the Libyan rebels. So many, many contacts and many information can be found on our website, for instance, regarding these operations.
Great, thanks. We come to this gentleman again, right here, and then need the microphone is coming. Okay, one, two, three, yep.
Thank you for your presentations and for the book. I will read it with great interest. Insofar as armed act, I'm Michael O'Neill from Save the Children International. Insofar as armed groups are also quite diverse, so are those providing humanitarian assistance. And I listened with great interest to some of the approaches that the ICRC uses to engage armed actors. But a lot of those strategies are predicated on ICRC's unique mandate. And my question is, outside of that mandate, what strategies would you recommend or have you found to be effective outside of dealing with the detention of combatants or negotiating or being an intermediary in conflict and other areas that non-ICRC providers of humanitarian assistance might apply?
Mm-hmm. Jenny?
Thanks very much. Jenny McAvoy from Interaction. My question perhaps is related a bit to Michael's, in that I couldn't agree more that humanitarian actors are quite often not nearly compliant enough with humanitarian principles, and that inhibits effective engagement with all parties to conflict. But I think there's another difficulty there, and adherence to IHL is not meant to confer legitimacy, political legitimacy, or further the aims necessarily of the actor that you're trying to get compliance from. And yet, that, in fact, is quite often the main incentive to comply with international humanitarian law, this desire for legitimacy. And it may be viewed in terms of, for example, winning hearts and minds. So pursuing that angle, pursuing that incentive in seeking compliance from an armed group, may, in effect, become a challenge for the humanitarian organization in terms of remaining impartial and neutral in its posture in that particular scenario. And I wonder whether, either from Vincent or from Marco, if you could comment on approaches to navigate that kind of scenario, to avoid to be seen to be partisan in pursuing those incentives. Thanks.
Thank you. And we have this woman right here.
Kay Ganan with the Charity and Security Network. This is partly a question, partly a comment, but it strikes me there's an elephant in the room in having this conversation in the United States with our material support law would criminalize much of the engagement that you're talking about. And I'd like to get your views on that issue and the effect that the U.S. law has had internationally.
Thank you. And we have the woman right here. Please turn off your cell phones.
Yes, thank you very much. Mona Ishmael from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights from the United Nations. Well, thank you very much for a fascinating and extremely interesting discussion. I actually have two questions. One for Vanda, please. It is very interesting that you looked at armed groups also in the context of urban armed groups. And my question to you is really about the legal framework in which you are entering into this discussion, because a lot of people tend to think, because it is called war on drugs, war on whatever, all kinds of wars, then we can use IHL in that, context. And clearly, we in the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights are extremely nervous about this notion and the fact that, you know, when there are people who happen to be criminal gangs, who happen to be fighting in a particular context, and you mentioned a few countries, actually Mexico and so on, where this issue is quite important. I am always extremely worried about expanding IHL in this area and having humanitarian actors enter into this area, because then you enter into the notion of who's a combatant, who's not a combatant, and then instead of looking into enforcement, law enforcement measures in a human rights context where we know exactly what we mean and what the use of force in that context can be, then we blur the area. So I'm a bit nervous about it, and I'd like you a bit to explain it. On Libya, our understanding is that there are, at this stage, four types of basically people in detention, or four types of detention facilities, but also four types of people in detention. Some people are really, the question is about the militias acting in Libya, and some of these militias, there is no doubt that they are not under total control of the government. Now, some of the people who are currently being detained are migrant workers. They happen to be people who are thought to be pro-Qaddafi loyalists. The big problem there is that there is currently no adequate review of detention, and there is no individual screening of detainees in all detention centers. So it's very difficult for us, and I think for you as ICRC, to say in a very firm way who are these people who are in detention. So I would like, maybe if you can tell us, how are you engaging with, and I think I know a bit about it, but I'd like if you can tell us a bit more, how you are engaging with regard to these four categories, government actors who are actually detaining people, but also militias, the security apparatus who is detaining also people, but not necessarily under the power of the government. Then you have the people who are totally outside the power of the government, and there we have secret detention centers that we are aware of. We know that there are people who are secretly detained with no access to anybody, including one very famous man who we know is the son of Gaddafi. So it's very important. I would be very, very interested in these two questions.
Okay, we have five very diverse questions. Some general advice to organizations that aren't ICRC in terms of working with armed groups. A question of whether working with armed groups, engaging with them, confers legitimacy on them. A question about the role of U.S. policies and material support, and does that make this conversation a bit irrelevant in terms of U.S. organizations engaging? Question about urban armed groups and some of the pitfalls, perhaps, of expanding IHL to cover criminal gangs. And finally, something about ICRC's experience in working with different types of Libyan detainees. We have about 8 minutes, so that means about a minute and a half per question, so it's bound to be profound. Wanda, you want to start?
Thank you. I'll pick up the question on the material support and criminalizing engagement. Now, I ended my comments saying that I think it's very problematic. And I say that while one of my hats is working on counterinsurgency and counterterrorism, but having that perspective, I'm quite aware that anti-money laundering laws and material support laws tend to have very limited effects on the physical capacity of armed groups. And often emphasizing the physical component of power and underemphasizing the political power that comes from having populations bound to them is deeply counterproductive. So while I see reason to have these laws on the books, I would like to see our administration having far more flexibility to issue exceptions for humanitarian actors. I mean, in many cases, it's just totally not enforceable. What is the big source of Taliban funding? It's money that is siphoned off from logistical companies that move money for the U.S. military. Obviously, you are not going to make the argument as a U.S. government that we should fine our military for having some of the money that are necessary for logistical supports seep to the Taliban. So while I would not say we should change the laws necessarily, at least I think there should be far more flexibility to allow exceptions on due diligence, not insist on unenforceable level of due diligence, for example, for the purpose of understanding that the larger fight is not just about the material power, but it's about where the sympathy, where the allegiance of the population lies. On the question of urban actors or urban armed groups, I'm not a lawyer, and so I would not want to enter the legal debate about what kind of law, whether human rights or humanitarian law, should apply to these actors. I would just say from a practical perspective, many criminal groups really function as proto-state. They control physical territories. I mean, the Rio example was brought up. When the CV, the Comando Vermelho, for example, controlled some of the favelas, you had a checkpoint that was manned by boys with machine guns, and they would pat anyone down who would want to enter. They controlled the territory. They acted as the rule. They said who could come in. NGOs could only come in with their permission, and the state would only come in through violent invasion. For all practical purposes, although they might not have political ideology, they ended as an armed combatant controlling important parts of territory. And as I believe that increasing urbanization in the context of rather profound and maybe increasing state weakness in many parts will lead to more territories looking in this manner, perhaps there is some need to readjust how we think about engaging these actors, what kind of humanitarian law, human rights law be applied to them.
Thank you. Mansan, let's go to you next, and then I'll give you a minute, then Marco, to talk about Geneva Call.
First, to answer your question, Mona, unfortunately, I don't have enough information, and as you seem to follow closely this, I don't want to go into the details of the Libyan case. Generally, ICRC does not comment on its work regarding detention, so I would not be in a position to give more information on this particular issue. But as I said, this is a concern for the ICRC, and we have been working on detention with the rebels when they were not yet the government, and we are continuing to do so. But on this particular case, I'm afraid I cannot give you more information. Regarding the two questions on lessons learned by ICRC and lessons learned which can benefit other actors, as Marco has the Geneva Conventions, mm-hmm. right there. Article 3 mentions that in situations of international conflict, the ICRC and other impartial humanitarian organizations can offer services, which points at the principle of impartiality. So it's true that the ICRC has a very specific mandate and a radical reading of the principles of humanitarian action. Other impartial organizations can also offer their services to armed groups and governments in times of non-international conflict. The ICRC cannot really talk on behalf of other humanitarian organizations. We can only share our lessons, and it seems that in today's conflict, adherence to the principles are the only ways that we find relevant to have access to, in the longer term, to the population in situations of non-international conflict. There were lots of questioning of the principle of neutrality in the wake of the Afghanistan invasion. I think these principles stood the test of time. Now every organization looks at its own mandate and its own priorities, but we would like to share these lessons. That's why we publish in the review. We try to publish also case studies and looking at the principles and how they were applied in the field. In the Afghanistan edition, we talk about that. We will talk also about that in these two editions on armed groups. So we hope that these lessons can be shared. Also, the arguments that we present to armed groups, which are also, I think, useful arguments that can be used by other organizations, are shared in these editions of the review. Regarding the question of the legitimacy, actually, armed groups can respect the law not only to improve their public image, they also decide to respect the law for many other reasons, like, for instance, because they want to win hearts and minds, because they want to get the support of the population. The legitimacy argument is, I think, exaggerated. Mostly by governments. I don't think that an armed group can benefit a lot from simply engaging with a humanitarian actor. I think this is largely a perception by the governments, which are very scared that actually an armed group can get this kind of legitimacy. Today we are engaging with all these armed groups around the world. I don't know if they benefit so much from that. So I would not overestimate this problem. It's more on the side of the government that it is a problem, a perception. So how do we navigate with government is actually the question. And there again, I think you asked the question about the criminalization of aid. We say states have to take into account their international obligations. States have given a right to humanitarian organizations to engage with armed groups for the protection of the civilian population. So when they draft legislations criminalizing what they call support or assistance, they need to make exceptions for the work of humanitarian organizations. And I think this is based also on the same Article 3, for instance, which gives the possibility to humanitarian actors to offer their services.
Okay, Marco, you had the last word for the last 2 minutes.
Thank you. One thing on legitimacy, you know, I don't like armed groups. I would prefer a world without armed groups. But armed groups are a reality, and they will not disappear because we ignore them. And the same thing, it's like Henri Dunant and humanitarian law. I don't think Henri Dunant or the people in the ICSC, they like armed conflicts. They would prefer a world without armed conflicts. But they came to the conclusion it is not by ignoring armed conflict that we can help people. And I think it's not by ignoring armed groups that we can get better results of respect. On the terrorism issue, I have to make my little coming out. I am a supporter of terrorists. Officially, for instance, a U.S. law school severed the possibility to have a law clinic with Geneva Call, which is an organization which is seen under U.S. law to support terrorism, because we engage armed groups, including armed groups which are considered by some states or by many states as terrorists, to comply with humanitarian rules. And if they comply with humanitarian rules, obviously they are no longer terrorists. But I think it's precisely those who are terrorists who must be engaged. And, well, when we speak with U.S. authorities, they tell us, oh, it's not about you. Don't. But this is the beginning of the arbitrary state. They could arrest anyone legally after tomorrow when I go to Dallas Airport. They could arrest me. But they say, we will not arrest you. But they could. So, indeed, I think we have a good legal argument for saying that Article 3 Common implies that impartial humanitarian bodies may offer their services, and that cannot be criminalized, and it doesn't make a difference between terrorist and non-terrorist armed groups. And now, two words about Geneva Call. It's an organization which tries to engage armed groups on very limited field, not to use landmines, not to use children, and now also on sexual violence. The first step is to get a deed of commitment, and that's symbolic. They come to Geneva and they sign a deed of commitment in the presence of the government of Geneva. There's no material support of terrorism law in Switzerland, fortunately, otherwise all of us would be arrested. And this gives them a sense of ownership. But then we start to say, okay, now you signed, and now we come to your place, and we want to see you deliver with your commitment. Obviously, for landmines, it's easier than for all humanitarian rules. So ICSE has a much more difficult work. And then, at the end, in some cases, when there is an allegation of violations, there have been even, has been, for instance, in the Philippines, with the agreement of the government of the Philippines and of the armed group, a fact-finding missions to find out whether there was actually violations. For the time being, we have such deed of commitment by 41 armed groups. Unfortunately, some of these armed groups are on terrorist lists. Now, we cannot eliminate them from and say, we don't want your commitment, because otherwise the government of Colombia or the government of Myanmar will say, our rebels are also terrorists. Why do you take them? And then we close shop. There is no armed group in the world which is not considered terrorist by the government against which the armed group is fighting. SPLA, you can see that in Sudanese government documents 15 years ago, was considered as a terrorist group. And so we cannot make the distinction between terrorists and non-terrorists.
Well, thank you very much. Join me in thanking the panel for a very provocative discussion. And thanks to all of you for participating.